From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR sports program, Only a Game. Return with us now to the days when two-time NBA MVP Steve Nash, who retired just this week, was a college guard who couldn't get the ball over midcourt, and to the days when nobody could have guessed that a surgical procedure would be named after a guy who'd win 20 or more games three times after he had it.
The first Tommy John surgery was on Tommy John, 1974, and from 74 to 94 was about 1 to 5 per year. In the last 20 years, it's been a rising.
Also coming up, Texas moves to discontinue steroid testing for high school athletes, and one dad questions our priorities regarding kids in sports. Stay tuned. After 19 seasons in the NBA, two-time MVP Steve Nash announced his retirement this week. He led the league in assists 6 times, and according to Phil von Buchwald, Nash's teammate at Santa Clara University back in the early 90s, Nash knew as early as freshman year that he'd make the league.
We had a required study hall we had to attend, and one night, as we were going through our homework, Steve looked up at me and said, "You know, Phil, I'm going to make the NBA." And so I'm going to say, there's no way you're making the NBA, and I'll put money on it.
They decided on $100, and based on the way Nash generally played during practice, von Buchwald thought his bet was safe. In scrimmages, Nash, a point guard, consistently failed to get the ball past midcourt because one of the defenders, a long-armed upperclassman named John Woolery, would knock the ball out of his hands and rush past Nash for a layup. Von Buchwald would retrieve the ball and inbound it to Nash, who would lose it to Woolery, who would score again.
So eventually, Coach Davey would simply say, "Stop, stop, stop." He'd walk towards me slowly as I was inbounding the ball. He'd take the ball from me. And basically, we took the walk of shame up the court, and Dick Davey would hand the ball to Steve and said, "Hey, can you run it from here?"
Coach Dick Davey remembers that walk of shame, but his happier memories are of scouting Steve Nash at a high school tournament in Canada, where Nash grew up.
I watched him warm up for about 15 seconds at the championships up there, and I was just praying that there were no other college coaches there because I thought we had a real diamond in the rough, and turns out I was right. When he got out of high school, he was a heck of a player.
And an extraordinary teammate, the kind of teammate who, at least according to Phil von Buchwald, made everybody else on the floor better. Nash also kept everybody loose. Von Buchwald remembers a game in which Santa Clara upset defending champs UCLA at a tournament in Hawaii.
At the beginning of the game, a couple of our guys would drive the lane and just get swatted, hard. The ball would get thrown into the bleachers, and we were also a little bit intimidated. And Steve kind of made a joke out of it. He would purposely drive down the lane, see the shot blocker coming, and just throw the ball about as high as he could. And it had no chance of going in, but they would swat it anyway, and it would be goaltending. Honestly, he showed us that we could beat him, that we could take him.
Nash also excelled at soccer, tennis, and various other sports, albeit not on the varsity level, but he could have done that. According to von Buchwald, one day after basketball practice, Nash borrowed a racket and held his own against some of the guys on the tennis team. If Coach Davey was watching that post-practice display, he probably wasn't surprised.
So when you're that gifted, you have that many different things, you owe a lot to your natural instincts and to your family and to your coaches, me excluded on that one. I didn't have much of anything to do with other than recruiting him. I didn't have a lot. But he was so good in so many areas. It's really a unique athlete.
You must feel incredibly lucky that he chose basketball with all those options.
Oh, yeah, I am. What it did, Bill, was kept me in my job for a lot more years. had he not been there, I probably would have been out of there in a hurry.
Coach Davey remained the head coach at Santa Clara for 9 years after Steve Nash ascended to the NBA. With Nash, Santa Clara made it to the NCAA tournament 3 times. They haven't been back since he graduated. When Steve Nash did leave Santa Clara, it was as a first-round draft pick. By senior year, that outcome was clear. So at the team banquet, Phil von Buchwald pulled a $100 bill out of his pocket and offered it to Nash.
Everybody laughed, obviously, in the audience, and Steve stood up and said, "Hey, why don't you put that $100 towards a plane ticket to come watch me play next year?" And I said, "That sounds great."
UConn women's basketball coach Gino Auriemma is among the 4 finalists for the Naismith Coach of the Year Award. So is Courtney Banghart, who coaches the women's team at Princeton. Coach Banghart is also on Fortune's list of the world's 50 greatest leaders, where she is joined by Bill and Melinda Gates and Pope Francis, among others. Gino didn't make the cut. Courtney Banghart, congratulations and welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be on. Thank you.
You led the Princeton women's basketball team to a perfect 30-0 regular season. Why was perfect deemed only good enough for a number 8 seed once it came time for the tournament?
I'm not sure. You know, I said in one of my press conferences that, you know, my second career is probably not going to be in bracketology because I clearly, although pretty well educated, I don't understand how it all works. Because I would have thought that we warranted a little bit different of a seed. But having said that, I have such great respect for and admiration for our players and how they handled it and how they approached their work without any sort of bad feeling and just got ready to play the game.
Your team fell in the second round to top-seeded Maryland, but in the first round you played Green Bay, a team that also had a great season, and they were only given a number 9 seed. Is there a problem with the way the NCAA selection committee seeds mid-majors in the women's tournament?
My hope is that this year really does force the NCAA to think thoroughly about the mid-major scenario, because scheduling, they keep saying, is an important piece of that. And scheduling is a difficult thing because you're only one half of that scheduling battery.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need the other opponent to be prepared to play you. And Green Bay and Princeton suffer from the same problem, and that's that we're having a tough time scheduling games.
Well, tell me a little bit about that problem that you share with Green Bay. You try to schedule games outside the conference against good teams so that, your team will get better. Why is that a problem? Why is it so difficult?
In the power conferences, their conferences are so tough, so they're trying to, pad their records, and so they're not really looking for additional top 25 caliber teams in the non-conference.
Mm.
And so it's hard as a mid-major, it just is. And, I think the success that 4 or 5 of the mid-majors have had this year are going to really challenge the thinking and try to think critically about how to grow the game.
Is it a matter of if you're a top team, a top 10 team, you say, we have nothing to gain by beating Princeton and everything to lose if they beat us?
Yeah, I think especially outside of actually the top 10, I think if you're looking at 10 to 30, in that range, I think people look at it like, yeah, there's just not enough to gain and there's a lot to lose, which I actually don't agree with because, Princeton, let's take Princeton, we've won, and Green Bay, they've won over 20 games each of the last 6 years, both teams. So a loss to a 20-game winning team is never a bad loss, regardless of who they are. So I don't understand it as much, but I also respect that every coach is trying to do what's right for them, and I don't try to pretend to know their challenges. But, as I look at the NCAA, it's a little bit easier to sort of say to the NCAA what's going on here, because the goal is to grow the game. And it's harder to do that if we don't. On the men's side, the best underclassmen are often going into the pros.
Right.
So you have experienced mid-majors against inexperienced BCS teams. So therein lies your parity in a tournament. I thought this year was a little bit of a unique, hopefully an anomaly, and hopefully something that forces the committee to think critically further moving forward.
After this conversation, I can't wait to see where your team is seated next year.
Well, let's get there first. But yeah, I agree. I think if we're gonna do our best again. We certainly didn't expect a 30-0 year, but we expected to have success, and we expect to have success again next year, and hope it gives us a good seed.
Courtney Banghart led the Princeton women's basketball team to a perfect 30-0 regular season, and then they beat Green Bay in round one of the NCAA tournament. Coach, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
First, the NFL required teams to evaluate players who might be concussed before allowing them back into the game, but players were still playing with concussions, so the league added independent spotters who would watch the games from above. That plan wasn't foolproof either, so on Tuesday, NFL owners approved a new rule giving those spotters the authority to contact game officials directly and halt play. Ben Utek played in the NFL from 2003 until 2009. His fifth concussion ended his career. Ben, you now speak on behalf of the American Academy of Neurology, though not on the particular matter of spotters. How's your health post-retirement?
I'm happy to say that, that I don't have a diagnosis. So from that perspective, I'm doing well, and I pray that day never comes. But I have been vocal about my memory issues. That's been one of the struggles I've faced. As a 33-year-old man who played 6 years in the NFL, it has been somewhat of an eye-opening struggle for me in certain situations.
I'm curious about how you feel about this new rule.
Well, honestly, on paper, it looks very good. I mean, this kind of control, especially revolving around a brain injury that occurs on a field of play, is necessary. So I applaud the NFL for taking a step in the right direction in that regard.
The spotter's rule has been referred to as the Julian Edelman rule because Edelman, who plays for the Patriots, was obviously disoriented at one point during the Super Bowl. At least one reporter says he heard a spotter in the press box alert the team that Edelman should be examined, but he never did come out of the game. I wonder if you feel the new rule somehow makes it less likely that that will happen.
Wow, well, therein is the question of the day, isn't it? You know, what actually happens behind the scene is, I think, is challenging. As a former player, these are the types of questions that we really need and want answers for. There has to be an accountability program. We need to make sure that if, in fact, the spotters are seeing things that need to be addressed, that the follow-through by the teams is occurring.
Do you think all of this considered, NFL players should feel safer when they take the field next season as a result of this rule?
I think that there is a level of safety because of this rule that hasn't been there in the past. And from this rule to the rule regarding leading with the head, you know, I believe that I might have been saved from some concussions because of that rule. So I definitely think that these rules are helpful. At the same time, you cannot have football without concussions. Because of that, what needs to take place is making sure that these organizations, who do a lot of good, but who also make billions of dollars off of players getting injuries, especially concussions, that those players are taken care of.
The last concussion you suffered occurred during training, not during a game. Has the NFL done anything to ensure that players are being evaluated when the cameras aren't rolling?
In my 6 years of playing and my 3 documented concussions, I never once saw a neurologist. I've often questioned why is a neurologist, the expert of brain diagnosis, never really involved in either sideline or the spotting position.
Of course, you'd also have to make sure that the doctors realized they weren't working for the coach.
Well, and that's the tricky thing, because when I was playing, you know, it was understood that doctors' offices, orthopedic practices, chiropractic practices, these people would be paying money to be associated with the team, right? That's a challenging balance to maintain.
Ben Utek played for the Indianapolis Colts and the Cincinnati Bengals from 2003 to 2009. Ben, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
If Major League Baseball has an Achilles heel, it might be the elbow. 4 decades after pitcher Tommy John became the first person to undergo the surgery that now bears his name, baseball is experiencing an epidemic. The number of pitchers having the surgery has skyrocketed, and MLB executives believe youth baseball is part of the problem. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
If I would tell you you've got a 50-50 chance, I'd be lying, because I don't know.
That's Tommy John. When he met a surgeon in 1974 to talk about replacing a tendon in his pitching elbow, the doctor wasn't exactly confident.
He said, you may go out and throw one pitch on rehab and it all comes apart. I don't know.
The doctor was L.A. Dodgers orthopedist Frank Job. Ulnar collateral ligament reconstruction was uncharted territory. Job proposed transferring an unneeded tendon from John's other forearm into his pitching elbow. With similar surgeries, Job had helped polio patients improve mobility in other joints. John said yes, but the doctor was concerned about another part of the pitcher's life.
My wife at that time was pregnant with our first child.
His daughter, Tammy, was born 2 days after the surgery.
Dr. Job was not worried about if I was going to come back and pitch. He was worried if I had a job or I had means to support my family when this didn't work.
But the surgery did work. John sat out the 1975 season and made his comeback the following year. Flash forward to 2015, and New York Mets ace Matt Harvey is about to do the same. Got hurt during a breakout year in 2013, had surgery, missed last season, and now he's back in spring training.
You know, we're getting ready for a season like nothing happened. So that's obviously a big change from last year, where I was just picking up a ball and kind of learning how to throw again. So, you know, I couldn't be happier with how things are going and how the workload is increasing and getting ready for the season.
Glenn Fleissig is the research director at the American Sports Medicine Institute in Birmingham, Alabama, one of the nation's top facilities for Tommy John surgeries and an MLB partner. I recently caught up with him after his talk at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in Boston. He says in four decades of Tommy John surgeries, there's a clear dividing line.
And from 74 to 94, about a 20-year period, the professional baseball players who've had Tommy John surgery, and when I say professional, I mean major and minor league together, was about 1 to 5 per year. In the last 20 years, it's been a rising.
A survey done a couple of years ago showed that 25% of all major leaguers and 15% of minor leaguers have had the surgery. Boston Red Sox manager and former major league pitcher John Farrell knows a little bit about it.
I think as an industry, you know, Tommy John surgery is an accepted procedure. And no one really shies away from it. You know, you're talking about a hinge in the elbow, and granted, it's a major surgery, but it's not like, you know, a shoulder where there's 6 or 7 muscles trying to create some joint stability there. I've had it twice myself, so unfortunately, you know, was never Matt Harvey before or after.
Glenn Fleissig says in the late 1990s, the number of surgeries among high school and college pitchers also began to climb.
Before that, kids were kids and they played multiple sports. About that time, though, specialization started to kick in.
And the big leagues are worried about it. New Commissioner Rob Manfred also appeared at the MIT conference and flatly told the audience that Major League Baseball is concerned that the Tommy John surgery surge is a direct result of overpitching in youth baseball. That's why MLB and USA Baseball, the governing body for the amateur game, have created a set of pitching guidelines and resources for young players called PitchSmart. There are pitch count and inning limits, but another core message is rest. For high school pitchers, the recommended time off includes 2 to 3 consecutive months without any throwing. Tommy John agrees and believes keeping track is not just a coach's responsibility.
Whenever I go out and I talk to parents, I said, who's the best pitcher in baseball? And they tell me their opinion. Does he pitch 12 months a year? Well, no. Well, why? Why shouldn't he do it to get better? And your kid who can't walk and chew gum at the same time, and he's out there throwing 12 months a year. Something's not right.
Today, about 80% of Tommy John patients come back to pitch again, but many lose velocity and breaking ball movement. In a video on the PitchSmart website, Dr. James Andrews, a surgeon and founder of the American Sports Medicine Institute, says that success can be a curse.
We see parents and young baseball players coming in just jumping at wanting to have a Tommy John's procedure when they're, say, 14 years old. They have no clue that that's not a good thing to have happen.
Before his procedure, Tommy John pitched 12 seasons in the big leagues. Then he returned for another 14 years, retiring at age 46. The surgery changed his life, and he's glad that it's helped save so many other baseball careers, but Tommy John would rather see young pitchers avoid Tommy John altogether. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
When Texas began testing high school athletes for performance-enhancing drugs in 2007, one official boasted, "We're going to test more kids than the NCAA and the Olympics." $10 million later, Texas is considering discontinuing the program after the first 19,000 tests caught only 9 steroid users. Don Hooten of the Taylor Hooten Foundation joins me now. Don, let's begin by talking about how you got involved in the issue of steroid abuse.
Well, the way we got started, and this was the hard way, our youngest son, Taylor, was a high school baseball player, 16 years old. His coach told him he needed to get bigger to improve his chances of making the varsity team in his senior year. And unbeknownst to the coach, when Taylor went back to the dugout, half of the boys on Taylor's baseball team were using anabolic steroids. And the long and short of it is Taylor began injecting himself with 2 different kinds of anabolic steroids, and 7 months later he died. And as parents, we were shocked to find out how dangerous these drugs can be, but probably even more shocked to find out how many kids across this country are, even today, playing with these drugs.
The Texas plan for testing students for steroid use has been criticized as at once too expensive and also, curiously enough, inadequate in that students aren't tested for a lot of the particular steroids they may be using. Is that legitimate criticism?
Yes, it is. I was a big supporter of this bill and worked with the lieutenant governor at the time. At one level, it's worth whatever dollars are required to put a program in place from where I sit. But if the program isn't implemented properly, what happens is what we've seen in Texas. You wind up defeating the purpose of the program because nobody tested positive.
Well, let me play devil's advocate on that one. Given how few students have tested positive, what's the evidence that high school athletes are using steroids in large numbers?
Well, let me refer you to the most recent numbers that we have, which was a study done by the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids. It was published last summer, and it is one of a series of studies that peg the usage rate amongst the general high school population nationally at 7% of the total high school population. And you put on top of that something we didn't test for, which is human growth hormone. We've got 11% of our high school students nationally that admit that they've used human growth hormone. So kids or athletes in general find the tests pretty easy to beat. One thing you might do, go on the computer and type in the words, how to beat a steroid test, and I think you will be overwhelmed with the number of products and instructions that are available to pass one of these tests, even under the best of circumstances.
Well, given the situation that you've described, what should Texas and by extension other states learn from the program in Texas?
What we need to learn is the only real weapon that we have in our arsenal is education. But sadly, 85% of our children nationally report that they've never had an adult, no coach, no teacher, no parent, no one. I mean, we talk to them about heroin and marijuana and alcohol, but we are investing minimal resources in teaching our kids why they need to be staying away from this junk.
If a coach says to a youngster, 15, 16-year-old kid, you need to get bigger and stronger, is the kid necessarily going to hear that as, I got to get some steroids?
No.
Is that still where we are?
No, I don't. And I'm glad you brought that back up because I don't mean to infer that the coaches are encouraging the kids to use these drugs. I'm sure we've got some out there that are doing it, but that's the exception to the rule. But when we do coaches training, we try to explain to the coaches that, you know, when old guys like me were in school, when you're told to get bigger and faster and stronger, the only things at your disposal were mashed potatoes and green beans and eating some more roast beef that mom is giving you. But the reality is today, these kids have easy access to illegal drugs and substances that can be very, very harmful to their health and their mental well-being in both the short and the long term.
Travis Tigert, the head of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, was quoted last week as saying it's a joke that Texans are willing to spend $60 million on a single high school football stadium, but they don't want to spend a fraction of that on protecting the health and safety of their athletes. That stadium is just down the road from you, as I understand it. So I'm wondering how you feel about Mr. Tigert's assessment of the situation there.
Oh, I completely agree with him. Somehow, our, you know, leaders just can't figure out how to come up with the funds to wrestle a problem like this, but we don't blink an eye at providing bigger and better facilities. Travis Tigert's right. We've got our priorities in this country upside down when it comes to our kids.
I can't help but wonder if building a $60 million high school stadium is in some way saying to kids, hey, you know, this game you're playing is important enough so that you ought to do anything you have to do to get better to play it.
Bill, I think you're exactly right. You're reading the cards properly. That is one of a number of messages. Just think about kids that are being asked when they're 10 or 11 to specialize. And at one level, it's great to encourage your kids, but combine that with a trip to the supplement store to convince them that there's a solution in a bottle that will make them better. I mean, I could go on and, ad infinitum with all of the different crazy signals that we're sending our children, then a $60 million football stadium is an awful strong message about where our priorities are and what's important to mom and dad and the taxpayers in our communities.
Don, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
Performance-enhancing drugs aren't the only dangers facing young athletes. Doug Cassa, chief operating officer of the Corey Stringer Institute, says the highest number of sports-related deaths in this country are among our 7 million high school athletes. Doug Cassa, how many athletes are we talking about in a given year?
In a given year, if we just focus on high school, you usually see between 20 and 30 deaths. We're also very focused on what we call catastrophic injuries that may not lead to death, and those will number in the hundreds.
You focus your study on four causes of death: sudden cardiac arrest, head injuries, heat stroke, and complications from the sickle cell trait. How did you narrow it down to just those four?
It's a good question. I mean, the research has shown that those four causes of death actually are about 90% of all the deaths that we see in high school and college sports. So it's not to say there aren't other things that could be dangerous for an athlete, like lightning strikes or something called hyponatremia or asthma. But those four that I mentioned, almost all of these conditions can be prevented. And in the case of heat stroke, for instance, death is 100% preventable if treated properly. And in the case of cardiac conditions, if an AED is placed on within a minute, they're 90% preventable.
In 2013, I understand that along with the National Athletic Trainers Association, you recommended that all 50 states adopt guidelines to protect athletes from sudden death. But in 2015, only 22% of the states have done that. Why is it so difficult to get everybody on the same page when it comes to something so basic as player safety?
It depends on which particular policy we're speaking of. I mean, some states have moved forward faster, for instance, like with some concussion policies as an example, but they've been a little slower maybe with heat acclimatization policies or AED policies, because at the high school level, you have to change policies on a state-by-state level. It's not like the NCAA or the NFL or professional governing bodies where one organization will influence everyone. I really think the last 3 to 5 years have just been a total monumental shift in the thought process, and we've seen a lot of substantial changes. As an example, with heat acclimatization in 2011, we had 0 states that met the minimum guidelines for heat acclimatization, which is kind of the key step to prevent heat stroke deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're at 14 states, and it might not seem like a lot, but of those 14 states, 10 of them are in the Southeast, and we still have not had a heat stroke death in any of those 14 states that have followed those policies. So that's powerful kind of ammunition for those other states to kind of move forward and adapt some of these policies.
I find it hard to understand how something so commonsensical as, hey, let's have some acclimatizing to heat conditions, could ever be controversial anywhere.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's controversial. Sometimes just change takes a little bit of time because they have to change what they've done for the last 50 years in high school football. They like to start out and have their two-a-day practices, and a lot of times it's a change of a mindset for them. So I do agree with you. It's very common sense. It's very simple changes, and the amazing thing is it costs no money at all. But when we usually get a chance to sit down and meet with them individually, most make progressive changes. 14 states meet the minimum standards, but to give credit, another 20 have made substantial changes in the right direction.
Doug, I haven't known you for very long, but I can tell that you are the ultimate glass half full kind of guy if you're talking about 14 states are on board and you're talking about progress.
Well, I guess it's the way of looking at it is that over 90% of all heat stroke deaths in America happen in concentrated states in the Southeast in our country. So probably saving, 3 or 4 kids' lives every summer just by the states we've gotten on board. So that makes me feel pretty good for those families. But yeah, we don't want to stop until we have 50 states, although my wife keeps convincing me we don't need Alaska for heat acclimatization. But I mean, that's just one example. There's a lot of really simple things we can do to keep kids safe. I mean, AEDs is a great example. It's only $1,000 for an athletic department to have one nearby cardiac's the leading cause of death in sport in America. And to have an AED there is almost a foolproof way of saving someone's life. And it's really a pretty small cost when you think of the benefit.
Especially when you're thinking in terms of a $60 million high school football stadium.
Or that, or when you think about the lawsuit, the lawsuits that emanate when deaths do occur that are preventable. I've been an expert witness on 35 cases where deaths have happened in sport, especially at the high school level. And in almost all the cases, the death was preventable with relatively simple policies and procedures that would have protected that kid that passed away.
Doug Cassa is with the Corey Stringer Institute, and along with the National Association of Athletic Trainers, he is promoting a nationwide standard for protecting the health of high school athletes. Doug, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
For our discussion of the week's news, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
I'm glad you cleared that up with that whole bit about the kitchen, because that was headed to a very strange place.
Oh, you knew I was not going to go anywhere. We didn't want it to go. You and I have talked about how much money the NCAA basketball tournament generates for the NCAA and, of course, for the schools involved. But a New York Times analysis suggests that more people watched meaningless bowl games this year than some March Madness matchups. What's going on?
Well, what's going on basically is football is the national pastime. Mm-hmm. I mean, football is the great outlier. It's to the point now where we almost shouldn't compare anything to football. And by the way, if this is the biggest sporting event of the year, is the basketball tournament that supplies the NCAA with something like 80% of its annual revenue, and more people are watching the bowl games, maybe we shouldn't refer to them as meaningless anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. The numbers here are really quite extraordinary. Wisconsin's first two wins in the tournament captured 2.7 million and 3.5 million viewers, respectively. The Wisconsin football team beat Auburn in the Outback Bowl, and 6.4 million people watched that one. So I think you're right. Football is just putting everybody else in the dust.
And let's be fair, Wisconsin, you know, was in prime time on a weeknight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Outback Bowl is during the holiday season. The basketball tournament, while it's undeniably exploded as a national event, really isn't at the level of television tradition the way, like, end-of-the-year bowl games are.
And, of course, we also saw a crying Piccolo player, and that exploded, at least in cyberspace.
It's a weird world we live in, Bill. I mean, this is a terrific story. She wound up, obviously, all over the internet, and then she got invited to it on Jimmy Fallon's show to play with Roots.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the most famous, you know, Piccolo player since Brian Piccolo died, I'd say.
I'd also say that this redefines or reestablishes the whole business about that 15 minutes of fame. Hey, enjoy it while you got it, right?
Yeah, you have 15 minutes of fame, but it lasts 20 years. it's like biblical time.
Charlie, the NFL instituted some rule changes this week, and I think the most significant of them gives two people looking out for concussions the opportunity to communicate directly with the officials and actually interrupt the game if they see somebody stumbling around the way Julian Edelman was during the Super Bowl. So, good rule?
It's a good rule. It's going to drive people insane. It's going to inflame the football KS macho crowd beyond all endurance. I'd be interested to see who these people are. Because it's going to be a fight between should we have neurologists or should we have, quote, football people. And if it's, quote, football people, then the system could collapse very quickly. If it's neurologists or independent observers, that makes this a much more interesting thing.
Well, and there's something else to consider in this. The so-called spotters, whoever they are, won't be employed by either team, but they will still be working for the league. What happens the first time the spotters see four or five likely concussions and the game lasts 7 hours because of all the delays to check out the guys who may have been concussed?
Well, you have to hope, and I certainly do not brim with hope in this regard, that the NFL would be willing to stay on the gaff and say, look, this is the price you have to pay to keep all of your favorite football players relatively safe. I mean, at the very least, it comes out as a wash. You may make the people in the stands impatient, but then again, you can sell a lot more beer.
Spoken like a marketing expert. Nicely turned. Absolutely. In NBA news, the Golden State Warriors have clinched their first division title since 1976. Will that achievement have any bearing on how the Warriors fare once the postseason begins?
It's hard to say because the Western Conference is such a bear trap at this point. I mean, you've got three or four teams you can plausibly see winning the NBA title. They're a very well-balanced team. They're a very good basketball team. Their record isn't a fluke because, as I said, they compiled that record in a very, very tough conference. But I'm going to have to see how that first playoff series goes.
And finally, Charlie, I invite you to share with our listeners one of the most striking provisions I've ever heard about in a will. It's the will of longtime UNC men's basketball coach Dean Smith. You want to take it from there?
Yeah, this is truly in keeping with the spirit of what Dean Smith was about in terms of his players. In his will, and we've seen letters from the executor of the estate to this effect, he left every letterman who ever played for him while he was at North Carolina $200 for the purposes of taking themselves out to a nice dinner.
I love it.
Of course, there is a codicil in the will that says that none of that money can be used to buy even an appetizer, even a glass of water for anyone from Duke. No, I just made that part up.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
With 2 weeks left in the NHL regular season, the Florida Panthers remain in contention for one of the Eastern Conference's wildcard spots. Two of the Panthers' key players this season have been rookie Aaron Ekblad and veteran Willie Mitchell. The 19-year-old Aaron and the 37-year-old Willie share more than a locker room. They share a home. Katie Baker has written about the roommates for Grantland. Katie, how was it that Aaron came to live with Willie and his wife, Megan?
During preseason, Willie and Aaron were paired up as defensive partners for part of it, and they became buddies both on and off the ice. Willie is a veteran player who's won 2 Stanley Cups with the LA Kings before coming to the Florida Panthers, so he had an interest in kind of coaching Aaron a little bit, and he slowly started to think to himself that it might be a great thing for him to do to host Aaron at his house for the season, because it's pretty unusual for someone as young as Aaron to live on his own in the first year. So he started coming home and telling his wife that Aaron was unlike most other 18-year-olds. And his wife had never met Aaron, so she was a little skeptical, but they finally wore her down, and now she refers to Aaron as her son.
While he was playing junior hockey, Aaron, like lots of young skaters, lived with a host family, but he says living with the Mitchells is not much like that. Why not?
He said living with the Mitchells is a lot more like living with a big brother and sister. They respect him as an equal. They rib him a lot, and he gives it right back, but he doesn't have that sense where he feels like he's having to tiptoe around them. They make him feel welcome. They cook him delicious meals, and they take him out on the boat and try to knock him off.
They cook him delicious meals, and they let him cook, too. He makes cookies.
Yeah. Willie Mitchell's wife, Megan, went to culinary school in California and graduated. So she's a phenomenal cook, so I think she's kind of inspired that in Aaron. His defense partner, Brian Campbell, told me that when he was still 18 years old, you know, in the fall, he got on the team plane with a barrel full of cookies. When I asked Aaron about it, he was kind of embarrassed that anyone had told me the story, but he said, you know, Meg makes these delicious chocolate chip cookies, and he wanted to learn how to make them. So he woke up one day before a long road trip and went down to the kitchen, and Meg helped him make a batch of cookies.
After your story was published, you tweeted, "The undisputed MVP of my Grantland story is the great Megan Mitchell." I'm not sure I'm at all surprised by that. This was really something that she managed to do.
Yeah, Megan Mitchell, I mean, you know, she takes care of these boys, her husband and her makeshift son. You know, they had a terrible flu when I first got there, and she was kind of the nurse in the sick ward. And not only that, she also has a role, you know, in terms of the team, because the team has relatively new ownership. So she's one of those people that's not afraid to go to ownership and say, we need closer parking for the families. You know, they have strollers. You know, she really has a role that makes you realize how important the families are to professional athletes.
Willie Mitchell and Aaron Ekblad obviously have a lot in common. They're both defensemen, and they play on the same team, and they live in the same house. But there is one crucial distinction, it seems to me, between them. Whereas Willie Mitchell took the long road to NHL stardom, Aaron Ekblad got there in the blink of an eye. I mean, this was a kid who everybody knew was going to, you know, be a 19-year-old sensation in the NHL.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Aaron Ekblad was drafted first overall, whereas Willie Mitchell was drafted in the 8th round of the draft. I think he was the 199th overall pick. And he joked that, you know, no one even calls you to tell you you've been drafted when you're drafted that low. I think he found out from his parents. Aaron is considered, you know, the future of the franchise, and Willie is more of a defensive defenseman, a role player. And he talks about how when you're someone like Aaron, you're given more of a leash to be creative on the ice, but at the same time, he's able to see what it means to be a role player and to be a leader without having to be a flashy player, which is what Willie does. And I think that's been a really important learning experience for him.
Well, when you're Aaron Ekblad, you're not only given more of a leash, you're given a heck of a lot of money, millions of dollars up front. I wonder if Willie is ever scratching his head and saying, boy, I wish I'd come along 20 years later when the paychecks were bigger.
It's interesting because from Aaron's perspective, he is almost jealous of Willie sometimes because Willie has this rich history and he has all these NHL stories about, you know, playing for Jacques Lemaire, and Aaron sits there and laps it all up, and he even said once that he lives vicariously through Willie, which I think is hilarious considering, you know, he's such the future of not just the team, but even the NHL.
Katie Baker is a staff writer at Grantland, and you can link to her story, The Roomies, at onlyagame.org. Katie, thank you very much for speaking with me. This was fun.
Thanks so much for having me.
Perhaps as dramatically as any former professional athlete, John Lucas has grown beyond his game. Lucas was an excellent college player at Maryland in the mid-70s. During his pro career, he bounced between teams from 1976 until 1990. Addiction cost him money and time, and it might have permanently ruined his life if he hadn't found and worked at recovery. He has since spent an enormous amount of his time and energy passing on that recovery. John Lucas, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you. And I love the title, Only a Game. I heard that title back in 1994.
John, for listeners not familiar with your story, I want to start by asking you to describe your struggles with addiction and how it affected your NBA career and beyond that, your personal life.
You know, drugs and alcohol made me violate every value that I ever had. I was the number one pick in the draft. And once I got to the NBA, Bill, I said to myself, now what? So I grew up as an adult athlete. I never grew up as an adult. So now, once I admitted to having a drug problem, for the last 29 years, I've had to go back and grow up as an adult. And guess what? It's painful. But recovery has been the greatest gift I've ever gotten. It's given me life after basketball.
Back in 1994, when you were a guest on Only a Game the first time, you were coaching the San Antonio Spurs, and at that time, you told me something about how you had built that team.
I did it based on almost like a 12-step recovery type of approach. We crushed each other's egos, accepted our shortcomings, believed in something greater than ourselves, and learned to care about one another.
If you were to go back to the NBA as a coach today, would the approach be the same?
Absolutely. You know, Popovich has said he wants people who are already over themselves. It's the same thing about crushing your ego. You've got to have some kind of belief in your teammate that they'll be there for you.
John, let's turn to some current basketball matters. The NBA's featured Sunday game is Houston versus Washington. You have an intriguing perspective on that game because you played for both teams during your career. Washington's John Wall and Houston's James Harden, both all-star guards. How would a young John Lucas have fared against either of them?
Well, with the rules today, I would have probably had to be a lot more offensive-minded right off the bat. That would be a big difference. But when I look at this year, I really believe James Harden is having an MVP type of season. And it's been great to see the maturation of John Wall. He's now getting ready to hit their prime. And guess what? They're now getting ready to be paid the bigger dollar.
There's another John Lucas in the NBA today. He's your son. He's a guard for the Detroit Pistons. How often do you get to see him play?
I don't go to any of his games. That's his life. As a former coach, I don't want to go because then I end up trying to be the coach. I just watch at home, and then I can turn the TV off and have no ownership in that game. Me and my wife can't watch when he gets in the game because I'm so angry because he only grew to be about 5'10". So I look at her, if I'd have married somebody else, so now I'm blaming her for his height. He's got my last name on the back of his shirt. But I'm really, really proud of John. He's been a ball boy ever since he was like 6 years old. It's always been a dream of his to play.
When we spoke back in 1994, I asked you about your plans beyond coaching and perhaps beyond basketball. Here's what you said then.
Today I'm the coach of the Spurs. How long are I a coach? I don't think I'm a coach long. But, you know, people don't say John Lucas, the coach of the Spurs. They say John Lucas, the first recovering addict, alcoholic, to coach a major league team. And I hope that I can stay sober so they'll give other people the opportunity. But coaching, I feel like I coached all my life anyway.
Do you still feel as if you're coaching all your life anyway in all sorts of ways?
Yes, I do. And, you know, I don't normally share this, but you guys seem to get me to talk about my feelings. When I coached the Spurs, we won 60 and 57 games. And I was miserable. And I was miserable because they were going to win 50 or 60 games without me as a coach. Then I left because I thought I was a coaching genius. And I went to Philadelphia and ended up coaching a team that did not have the talent. I went to like the third rated coach to the 29th rated coach in 1 year. What happened? Then when I went to Cleveland to coach, it was all about getting LeBron James. And then they fired me before we could get to LeBron James. So what I did was started camps for fourth, fifth, and sixth graders at an elite level, seventh and eighth graders at an elite level. And I always say to them, greatness is overrated. But everybody wants a little bit of greatness at some time.
Former NBA player and coach John Lucas has operated his Houston-based wellness and aftercare program since 1986, and there he helps high school players and former pros and just about anybody in need of drug and alcohol treatment and rehabilitation. John, it's great to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
Thanks a whole lot.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. And our intern is Keely Flanagan. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from former Santa Clara coach Dick Davey on his former star, Steve Nash.
Kept me in my job for a lot more years. Had he not been there, I probably would have been out of there in a hurry.
That line is so good, I just wanted to hear it again. And, of course, to thank all the talented people who have enabled me to stick around here. I'm Bill Littlefield. If they keep it up, I'll be back next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.